GTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information on all that Carthage offers is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very excited to be reconnecting today in this portion of the morning show with author Marta McDowell. We spoke previously on the morning show about a truly exquisite book and illuminating book called Emily Dickinson's Gardening Life, in which we were taken, in a sense, behind the scenes of Emily Dickinson's life as a human being and as, of course, one of the most gifted poets of her generation. And in particular, examined the role that gardening and the beautiful outdoors, what role that played in her life and in the way she saw the world. That book was written by Marta McDowell, who has also written books like Beatrix Potter's Gardening Life and All the President's Gardens. Her most recent book is called Unearthing the Secret Garden, The Plants and Places That Inspired Frances Hodgson Burnett. Ms. Burnett was one of the most interesting writers of her generation, living from 1849 to 1924, prolific and popular, and also someone whose life involved a little bit of controversy. Burnett was someone who also loved gardening, drew tremendous inspiration from it, and of course, her love of gardening had a very direct inspiration upon her beloved work, The Secret Garden. We'll explore all of that with Marta McDowell. The first line of her biography reads that she lives, gardens, and writes in Chatham, New Jersey. She teaches horticulture and landscape history at the New York Botanical Gardens, and she is the author of a number of different books, including those that I have mentioned, and this most recent book, Unearthing the Secret Garden. Marta McDowell, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. I'm so pleased to be here.
I'm glad we can reconnect and have this conversation. Can you remind our listeners, I think we probably talked about this last time, but it would be great to revisit the question of the role that gardening has played in your life and at what point in your life gardening became so important to you.
Yes, well, I had some family in central Illinois, and they were very avid gardeners. And so I think that seed was planted when I was very young. I also received a book, The Secret Garden, which I really loved. My parents were not gardeners, but when I got my own little piece of property, I started to garden myself. And it wasn't until about 20 years later that I took up gardening and garden writing and teaching about gardening as a profession. But I've always been a very enthusiastic gardener.
Tell us about the work that you do right now, aside from your writing. I'm thinking particularly of the teaching that you are doing right now.
Yes, I typically teach adults. The New York Botanical Garden has a wonderful school, actually a pair of schools. One of them is for people who just are interested and might want to, you know, have a certificate or explore different aspects of the plant world. And then there's also a two-year professional diploma program. So I teach in both of those schools, and I have the most wonderful students who come from all walks of life and just are incredibly talented. And I learn so much from them and try to teach them a little something too.
Terrific. At what point did it begin to occur to you that you could connect your love of gardening to the world of literature and, in a sense, help illuminate for the world the lives of some of these writers for whom gardening was such an important part of their lives? When did that connection first occur to you, and with whom?
It started with Emily Dickinson. So I can really say that in a very direct way, Emily Dickinson changed my life. And it was all thanks to a museum. So, you know, I send out my warmest thanks to all of those people that toil in the field of small museum curation and keeping these places open. Because I happened to be in Western Massachusetts. I was actually on a business trip and had one of those open afternoons on my schedule, which happens occasionally. And I picked up a brochure it was called the Emily Dickinson Homestead at the time, and went up to Amherst and took a little tour and found out that Emily Dickinson, who I had studied for, you know, probably grammar school, but certainly high school and college, that she shared something with me, and that was she was so interested in her garden. And so it just sent me down this track, the way life can change in a very, you know, strange and wonderful way. And that was the beginning. And from then on, it was like, are there other people who share this kind of interesting pairing of writing or maybe painting and gardening?
And as you have explored this now repeatedly, have you come to any general conclusions about what it is about gardening that makes it an especially rich connection for these writers? I mean, versus other hobbies like, I don't know, stamp collecting or whatever. What do you think it is about gardening that that makes it a common and very, very meaningful connection with so many writers?
I think some of it is that connection with the natural world, and that gardening, there's a lot of routine in gardening. You know, not every instance in the garden is a really wow moment. You know, a lot of it is goldweed, you know, seaweed, goldweed, you know, thin the 100 seedlings into the 8 strongest ones. And so it's kind of meditative. It's quite different from writing, right? When I'm writing, I'm often indoors. Nowadays, of course, I'm also sitting at a keyboard, you know, so I'm sitting generally at a chair. And you're working through something that I think kind of works one side of the brain. I just think being out in the garden and working with living things is a quite different way to make your brain work. And it just, for some people, it really lights things up.
So for your explorations of these different writers, and specifically Frances Hodgson Burnett, did you come to it in a sense with a largely blank slate? I'm thinking not a completely blank slate, of course, but how much did you need to learn about them as writers in order then to be able to draw meaningful connections with their life as gardeners?
I really didn't know anything about Burnett when I started out. So, you know, a few years ago, I thought, well, you know, I always loved The Secret Garden. I wonder about Burnett. The only other thing that I could bring to mind that she had written was another children's book called A Little Princess, which typically, if people know her name at all, because she's not a household name anymore, those will be the ones they might name. And it surprised me when I found out that she wrote, you know, between 30 and 40 novels for adults, and lots of short pieces, short fiction, nonfiction articles, dramatized many of her works. In fact, I came across a photograph of many of Emily Dickinson's friends and family who were in a kind of home amateur theatrical of one of Burnett's books called A Fair Barbarian. And so she was on everybody's lips, especially after she wrote Little Lord Fauntleroy, which was kind of her really big breakout novel, because that one, which, you know, isn't well remembered anymore, that one was really enormous for her. So, you know, it's like, I didn't know much about her. I just assumed she must have gardened.
And you were so right. And of course, that is what you
expect.
Yes. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Marta McDowell about her latest book, which is called Unearthing the Secret Garden, The Plants and Places That Inspired Frances Hodgson Burnett. So before we talk specifically about The Secret Garden, I think it would be good for you to summarize for our listeners something about the extraordinary life of Miss Burnett, and in particular, the way in which she was a woman whose story, personal story, is replete with surprises. I mean, I think for most of us who know this lovely work, we would never guess that the woman responsible for writing the story had a life that was, in a sense, as checkered and difficult and even controversial as she did. Tell our listeners what you think is most important for us to know about Frances Hodgson Burnett, aside specifically from The Secret Garden, which we'll next explore.
Sure. So she was born in England. She was raised in the area of Manchester in the north of England, and she was born to a comfortable family. So she's one of five children. Imagine her in the middle, and she's being raised as a proper British girl, you know, sent to school, you know, has a nursemaid and that sort of thing. Her father dies when she's young. The family business falls on hard times, and gradually the Hodgson family falls into poverty, and the last thing her mother does is sort of scrape together enough money to move her children to Tennessee, and so that she will be, you know, sort of under the protection of her brother. And so that is what they do, and her brother, the children's uncle, gives the two boys, the eldest, work. And ships off the women of the family, so her mother and Frances and her two sisters, to live in Newmarket in a little house he owned that was sort of a shack from, you know, descriptions of it and one little sketch. And I think that these women, if not for the kindness of neighbors in Newmarket, Tennessee, might have starved. You know, they just scraped by. And it was in Newmarket that Frances, who was always a creative child, started to write down stories and eventually sends one into Godey's Ladies' Book. So from the time she's 19 years old until really on her deathbed, she was a professional writer, very generous with her family. She brings her family kind of back up into, you know, at least a comfortable way of life. And also really does love to spend money. So I will say, as generous as she was, she also loved to buy clothes and, you know, eventually decorate houses and entertain. And so she's quite a personality. She is now a professional writer. She starts to travel. And she decides she is going to marry a local boy from Newmarket. He's studying to be a doctor. They move with their first baby boy, one servant, and soon Frances becomes pregnant. They move to Paris so he can finish his training. She supports the family. They move to Washington, D.C., where he sets up a practice. She really still is supporting the family. And yet she does entertain. She then is quite lavish and keeps writing and writing and writing and writing. So, you know, her career goes on. She's traveling more and more. She's dramatizing her plays. And she and her first husband sort of drift apart. And then one of the older sons get quite ill, and he eventually dies with his mother in Paris, and that's where he's buried. And so she has this very long period of grief. France always seemed to have these alternating periods of deep depression and then very, very productive periods. So she always had problems. In fact, there's a letter from Louisa May Alcott where she mentions this, that, you know, Mrs. Burnett mends slowly, but is quite overworked. Frances eventually divorces her first husband. You know, their one remaining son has graduated Harvard by this time, and she settles in a country estate that she rents in Kent in the south of England. She's around 50 years old, and that is when she really starts to garden. So Frances does not garden until the last quarter of her life. She does have a brief, very unsuccessful second marriage. You know, she survives that. She moves after 10 years from this beloved home and garden in the south of England to a new house that she builds on Long Island so she can be closer to her son, Vivian. And she splits her time between Long Island and Bermuda, where she gardens in both places. And that is where she finishes her life when she's 74 years old. Mm-hmm. That's it in a nutshell.
It's quite a life. And that second marriage, of course, attracts a great deal of, let's say, unpleasant attention in that that man she marries is much younger than she is. And many observers believe that he is not in love with her, but simply trying to marry somebody who can help him achieve his aspirations as an actor. And as you said, that second marriage does end very, very quickly. You also said something intriguing, which is probably worth noting, that although she experienced periods of depression, those periods of depression and or simple sadness also seem to have perhaps been fuel for all of the writing that she did, or at least in many instances. Can you just tell us more about what you think that connection was?
Well, I think it's sad but true, Greg, is that, you know, if people are only happy, they might not have a lot to write about. You know, it's that contrast that so often, you know, really fuels a writer and makes it interesting for a reader because they can see themselves in that too. Because, of course, who gets to be happy every day? Now, in terms of Frances and her son dying, while I don't know this for a fact, you know, this is my 2 cent hypothesis, I always believe now that the Secret Garden, where it has this theme of healing, that it's her little chance to rewrite, at least in fiction, the end of her own son's story, that she could, you know, she couldn't save Lionel, but she can save Colin at the end of the book.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Marta McDowell, and we're talking about her latest book, which is called Unearthing the Secret Garden, the Plants and Places That Inspired Frances Hodgson Burnett. Your book, among other things, not only outlines some of the essential information we need to know about Frances Hodgson Burnett and her complex and colorful life, but also you give us lots of information about, in particular, three gardens that she created during this latter part of her life when gardening became so important. And it would seem that one of those gardens, the one in Kent at a place called Maithan Hill, has a very direct connection with the story of the Secret Garden. First, tell us about this particular garden, exactly where it was and at what point in Burnett's life we are talking about when she created this lavish and lovely garden.
So after her divorce from her first husband, Frances, you know, it seems to be a sort of watershed for her. And she writes back to her family in America that she has decided she wants to rent a country place, that it will be so good for her writing. And that, oh, can't you live much more cheaply in the country? You know, that turns out to be sort of ironic because what Frances decides to lease is a country house that's on an old manor grounds. It's 200 acres. It's enormous. It has, a 2-mile carriage road through it. Gatehouses on either end with tenants, with lots of staff, and, you know, a huge place, basically, that she starts to redo even before she moves in. So I don't know that it was really any cheaper to live there, but she did have a grand old time. And she created this very special garden among its beautiful park with old trees, you know, imagine these big oaks and chestnut trees and beech trees on this rolling Kent countryside. There are walled gardens, and one of them in particular, this old orchard that had these kind of, oh, think of them as, you know, kind of contorted old fruit trees that have lichen on their bark and maybe not quite so many leaves anymore. She decides she's going to make that into her rose garden. Not a very prim and proper sunny rose garden, but a very romantic kind of arts and crafts garden. And that's where, when the days are nice, you know, when the weather is fine, that's where she has her chair and writing table, and she actually writes out in the garden. So it's that garden. I mean, she later writes to one of her friends that the Secret Garden was, quote, our rose garden, as if it had been locked up for years and some hungry children had found it. And she writes the book after she loses this property. You know, partly it was her choice and partly the owner wanted to sell it at the time.
And so she, from the sounds of it, experiences something of a wrenching loss. That is when she leaves and I think resettles back to America, to New York State. She's really in kind of a emotionally bereft state, leaving this garden behind. Am I remembering that correctly?
That's absolutely right, Greg. I mean, she said to her sister Edith in a letter, "This is the only place I ever felt like I was home, real home." And she lets it go. Remember, she's only got this one son left, and he wants her to come back. He worked in New York City. He wanted her to build a house nearby so that he could come and be with her on the weekends. And that's what she decides to do. I think, you know, many people decide at one time of their life or another that they're going to choose to be near their children.
So as for the Secret Garden, this is an amazing work and one that has been beloved over generations. I think you tell us it has never gone out of print and continues to resonate to this very day. And of course, many people have seen the classic film version, and probably many of our listeners are also aware of the beautiful musical that was crafted based upon The Secret Garden. Tell us a little bit about the circumstances under which she wrote this and the way in which it was initially received.
So she gives up Maytham Hall, and in the interim period, the house is being built on Long Island, and Frances basically leaves that to her son. You know, it's like she delegates that, all that misery of construction, and all just travels around Europe mostly and signs the checks and is writing in the meantime. And it is during that period that she produces The Secret Garden, the manuscript. So she does not set it in Kent. Kent is in, you know, it's south of London. Maytham Hall was about 10 miles from the English Channel, if that helps, you know, sort of position where it is. She set it in Yorkshire at an estate called Misselthwaite Manor. So it has that sort of Bronte sisters kind of feel to it. I think she was kind of going for the Gothic. The Secret Garden also has these echoes of, you know, the wife in the attic, because the main character, Mary Lennox, hears cries in the night, and she doesn't know what that is. And it turns out she has this cousin that she didn't know about. Misselthwaite Manor is her uncle's estate. She has been orphaned. She goes to live with her widowed uncle. So, and in fact, one of Burnett's friends said, "The Secret Garden is the children's Jane Eyre." So if you've ever thought that, you're in, you know, you're right spot on. So Frances does indeed move to America, you know, comes back to America, and she does settle on Long Island. Her new home is called Plandome Park. It's a very big, comfortable house on 3 acres. It's not a grand estate. It's not like, you know, the Vanderbilts or the Goulds, those people were building. But it's a very big, lovely home, and she creates gardens. And it's in 1910, she's living at Plandome, that The Secret Garden comes out first in serial form, so in a magazine called The American Magazine. And then the following year, it comes out in book form in both New York and London, so both America and in Britain. It wasn't actually, Greg, a bestseller. It sold well. You know, she got very good feedback about it, but it wasn't a huge bestseller at the time. So I think she'd be very perplexed about its, you know, its ongoing life.
Right. And of course, that is exactly what it has enjoyed. One of the things that I think is so intriguing is that although I have always loved the story, I find myself appreciating it on a different level now, having learned so much about the author, Frances Hodgson Burnett, who she was, the kind of life she lived, and the themes from her own life that find their way into this particular story. There's something so very, very intriguing about that. Can you tell us more about the really direct connections that you see thematically, even aside from the presence of that beautiful kind of magical garden at the heart of the story?
Well, there were so many instances in Burnett's letters that connected back to what she ended up putting in the stories. She'd write in her letters from her home in Kent about the emergence of spring, the season of spring in England, and how the lanes were all greening, and she would hear all of the birds singing and start to see those little bulbs push through. And that all appears in The Secret Garden. She also befriended, in a very specific way, a robin in her garden. Not a, when I was a child, I thought it was a robin, an American robin, because, of course, I grew up in America. But Frances meant a little English robin, and they're about the size of a wren, and they are quite inquisitive birds. I had a chance to work in England for a six-month period once, and they'd always show up when you were gardening. Well, this one she really befriended, and she could evidently whistle, and it would come because her friends talked about it. And so the following year, after The Secret Garden is published, she actually writes a very little book called My Robin, the true story of her robin, and she puts that out as a sort of, you know, supplement or follow-up book.
Your book includes information on the three gardens that Frances Hodgson Burnett created, including the one that we described in Kent at Maithan Hall. And you're even able to share with us information on what these gardens looked like and the flowers that were especially important to Burnett. Tell us how we can know so much about these gardens and about these sorts of specific matters related to Burnett's gardening.
Well, God bless letter writers, Greg. And just like everything else in her life, Burnett was a prolific letter writer. You know, I'm so happy that I research people who are not, you know, on email and texts, because I don't know what researchers will do in the future, but I rely on letters. And, you know, sitting in reading rooms in very nice archives, God bless librarians and archivists, and reading through folders and folders of her handwritten letters. And she wrote a lot about her garden, and her son also wrote a lot about her gardens, because when she was away, I mean, imagine, she's in Bermuda for, you know, 4 or 5 months a year. He is taking care of her garden on Long Island. He eventually marries and builds a house next door. And so it's sort of their joint garden in a way.
Hmm. Your book also includes an essay by Frances Hodgson Burnett, I believe published only after her death, called In the Garden. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Yes, so Burnett dies in 1924. She dies in her New York home, Clandome Park. She dies of colon cancer. On her deathbed, really, you know, on her final illness, she is writing a series of articles for a magazine called The Country Gentleman. It was a very popular magazine at the time. When she dies, her son decides that he is going to put those essays together and publish them instead as a small book. And it's very difficult to come by. If you buy it, you know, on the secondhand market, it's quite expensive. And since it's so long out of copyright, we decided to put it in the back of this little book so that people would have it and be able to read about her garden in her own words, which is a wonderful thing because, unfortunately, you know, she wasn't alive during the era of radio when she might have been recorded. So, or at least if she was alive, she was never recorded. So there's no trail that way.
But her voice, in effect, lives on in this way. And, of course, in so many other ways, in this beautiful book, we are able to gain remarkable insight into her life, and into her life as a writer, particularly as it pertains to this beloved work known as The Secret Garden. The book, again, is titled Unearthing the Secret Garden, The Plants and Places That Inspired Frances Hodgson Burnett, and the author, Marta McDowell. Marta McDowell, you've done it again. You've given the world yet another exceptionally beautiful and interesting book, and I'm so glad that we got to talk about it today on The Morning Show. Thank you so very, very much. Happy writing and happy gardening.
Thank you, Greg. It was my pleasure.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two is coming up in just a moment. We are going to be exploring some amazing stories for the next few minutes about some amazing women. The book at hand is called Wonder Women, 25 innovators, inventors, and trailblazers who changed history. But the names are going to be names that will be all but completely unknown to you, or at least they were to me. And that's so exciting to read a book which introduces us to incredible women who did incredible things, but whose stories are largely lost to us until, that is, the good work of Sam Meggs, an assistant writer for BioWare, author of The Fangirl's Guide to the Galaxy, and the author of this new book, Wonder Women, published by Quirk Books. Sam Meggs, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really like the way this book is laid out with five sections: women of science, women of medicine, women of espionage, women of innovation, and finally, women of adventure. At one point in your book, you point out a facet of this that I think is worth talking about. In one reason why we don't know so much about women astronomers, for instance, or women mathematicians, is because there weren't as many of them because there were all kinds of doors shut to women. But that's not the whole story. Your book also points out that in some cases, men actually sort of swooped in and sort of snatched away credit that rightfully belonged to women who had actually come up with a given innovation, and that your book is an effort to right some of history's wrongs. Can you give our listeners one or two examples of a historical wrong in which a man took credit for something that a woman, in fact, had accomplished?
Yeah, that's definitely an unfortunate common theme throughout the book. I mean, so many women throughout history have had amazing accomplishments in STEM that have either been erased by time or they weren't able to take credit for because of their gender or race, or like you say, in this case, stolen by their male colleagues. I think the most famous example of this, which I touch on briefly in the book, is Rosalind Franklin, who discovered the structure of DNA only to have it stolen by Watson and Crick, who we read about in our textbooks now. In Wonder Women, I talk about Alice Ball, who was the first woman and first African-American to get a master's degree from the University of Hawaii in 1915. And at just 23, she invented a cure for leprosy, the first viable cure for leprosy, but died as a complication from the process of that invention. And her male boss was like, I got this invention I came up with recently and took credit for it. And the cure was named after him, which is very unfortunate. Another example of this in the book is Margaret Knight, who was actually in the early 1900s, the woman who invented the machine that makes flat-bottomed paper bags. So when you get takeout food and you put it in a paper bag, she invented that. But she actually she had to sue for her patent after her design was stolen by a man who had seen it and tried to claim it as his own. And his main defense was that a woman couldn't possibly have created something so ingenious. So she won, of course, because she made it, but it was pretty rough.
Right, right. One of the things that's really clear is that although, for instance, I found this book just endlessly fascinating and revelatory, you clearly have written this book with younger readers in mind, or maybe not exclusively younger readers in mind, but for instance, when we read at one point that this is a journey into the history of bad as heck babes, that tells us that this is a book written not so much for college professors to read as it is maybe for young girls to really derive some inspiration. Talk about that.
Accessible as possible, because I think when a lot of people think about history books, they think about really boring tomes or textbooks or really things that are really impenetrable to most people or uninteresting. You know, I wanted to approach this topic in as friendly and approachable and humorous a way as possible, because, you know, there are so many injustices done to women and to these women in particular that if you don't laugh about it, you're going to cry, I think, first of all. And also, I think we see a real lack of role models in STEM fields, but science, technology, engineering, and math for young women. So it was really important to me to be able to bring these stories to the forefront so that girls who want to get into these fields, who maybe want to get into coding or video games or engineering, can look at this book, particularly women of color and queer women whose stories are almost never told, and say, look, women like me have been successful at this before. Maybe I can be successful at this too.
I was really amazed that so many of these women were so far back in history. I really wasn't expecting some of these stories to reach really into ancient times, or just back further than I would have thought was possible in terms of women enjoying these kind of tremendous accomplishments. It's quite exciting. I think it would actually be really interesting in terms of giving our listeners some idea of that, to talk about the very first woman you speak about in the book, the first biography in the section of women of science. You talk about an extraordinary astronomer from China from the 18th century. Talk about her and what she accomplished.
Oh, absolutely. Her name was Wang Zhenyi, and she was born in 1768 in China, where women were basically just sewing and having babies and weren't allowed to go to school. And, you know, all that stuff that happened in the 1700s wasn't so great. But she actually became a highly accomplished astronomer and mathematician and poet, and was the first person using a model that she built in her garden using a fountain and some other practical effects, was the first person to discover how eclipses worked. So she made kind of a whole, you know, grade school science experiment that was modeled the movement of the sun and the moon and the earth. And this was while in the West we were still figuring out whether the earth was flat or not. She was like, I know how eclipses work. Meanwhile, in China, this woman in the 1700s figured out eclipses. So pretty impressive.
Right. And you tell us about the protest poetry that she also wrote. I mean, she was a well-rounded woman, and we so appreciate hearing about that. We hear about a Chinese inventor of textile technology who dates back actually to the 13th century. And I'm just really impressed that you were able to uncover such wide-ranging stories spanning so much of world history. What kind of a challenge was that for you to uncover the stories of some of these women who are simply not represented in standard history books or textbooks?
Oh, thank you for saying that. Yeah, I think we often have a really white sort of Western view of things. We hear a lot about British and American women, and I do have those women in the book, but we often forget that women in India and China and Japan and Peru and all over the world were also making great strides throughout history and science. So I really wanted to try to make the book as diverse as possible, but it was definitely a challenge, more of a challenge, to dig up those stories, because those narratives in particular are really buried. So I did a lot of research, a lot of looking back into women's history textbooks, history of medicine textbooks. One resource that I really enjoyed using in the States was a website called Chronicling America, which is a newspaper website that archives all old newspapers throughout the States from the 1800s to the early 1900s. So if you want to find out what was going on in your community in, say, 1860, you can go ahead and log on to that website and take a look at the newspaper from that day in history. And it's super fascinating. All kinds of lost stories you can find that way.
Right. I want to make sure that you mention one of my favorite women from this book, Maria Sibylla Merian, a German explorer who set off on an extraordinary journey to South America that is really probably one of the first journeys of its kind in which someone traveled halfway around the world really for the sake of science rather than commerce.
That's right, yeah. So she was born in 1647 in Germany, and she wanted to become a painter, even though women weren't even allowed to use oil paints at that time based on guild rules. But what she really enjoyed painting were insects and the environment in which insects thrived. So she traveled all the way to South America. It was the first self-funded scientific journey ever, because no one would fund a woman to go to America for science. So she sent herself and her daughter, and actually was the first person to catalog a ton of South American entomology. And some of her paintings are still the only examples that we have of insects that have since become extinct. So she was pretty cool.
Incredible. Before we have to let you go, I want to make sure you talk about the appendix at the back of the book, which is called How to Become a Woman of Wonder. Explain what that's about.
I really wanted this book to sort of act as a resource for young women, or women of any age, really, or people of any age to feel empowered to be able to do these things for themselves if they felt inspired by the women in this book. So I just compiled a list of resources and, companies and programs right now that you can get involved in. If you're interested in this sort of stuff, like Girls Who Code, if you want to learn how to be a programmer at any age, you can learn how to make your own video game, all sorts of women exploration groups and things that you can join to either learn or help out women in your community who want to learn.
The book, again, is titled Wonder Women, 25 Innovators, Inventors, and Trailblazers Who Changed Histories, published by Quirk Books, and the author, Sam Maggs. Sam Maggs, congratulations on a terrific book. I'm glad we got to talk about it. Best wishes.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Pascal Arino from the Brescine Symphony Orchestra tells us about their upcoming Fall Masterworks concert. And we hear from two cast members, the director and producer of the Fleeing Artist Theater's production of Neil Simon's comedy classic, The Odd Couple. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Thursday, my conversation recorded live at UW Parkside last week with history professor Dr. Sandra Motes, talking about her new book called Navigating Neutrality, a look at the 1793 Proclamation of Neutrality.